Clytus, I'm bored. What plaything can you offer me today?
Is that War Rocket Ajax? To bring back his body?
To War Rocket Ajax. It's the internet's most destructive comic book and pop culture podcast, and we are your hosts. I am the splendid Chris Sims, and with me as always is my co-host, the warlord of Podcast Town, Supremus Combo. Matt, how are you doing tonight?
Who run Podcast Town?
I bet everybody can guess what my wrecks are going to be this week.
I still haven't seen it yet, so I'm amped to go actually tomorrow.
So by the time this goes up, you will have seen Mad Maxwell Furious Road.
That's right, and let's leave it at that because I know we're going to be talking about it more. We have to talk about our amazing guest that we have coming up on this episode, Jeremy Whitley, the writer of Princeless.
We will be talking to him about Princeless. We'll be talking to him about his upcoming story in Secret Wars. And we'll be talking a surprising amount about the Sam Raimi action pack of syndicated action shows from the late 90s and early 2000s. So if that sounds like it's fun, stay tuned.
In particular, Cleopatra 2525 comes up a shocking amount.
Yes. Very early on, too, which usually we get a little bit in before we have those tangents. But Matt, what do you say we go ahead and kick off the show?
Yeah, let's first thank some of our backers on Patreon.
Oh, are these people who have gone to patreon.com/warrocketajax and helped support the show, keep the lights on, and pay those gimmicks they keep sending in the mail called bills?
That's right. Keeping the trend alive of saying that phrase every episode.
I love it. It makes paying your bills so much less painful and awful when you call them those gimmicks they keep sending in the mail.
If we get up to a certain amount of money, we will do an entire version of a Stone Cold Steve Austin ad. That is our true promise. We still haven't decided what our next goal on Patreon is going to be.
Well, if you are a Patreon backer, or if you are thinking of becoming a Patreon backer, why not drop us a line and let us know what you would like us to do? I think our next goal is probably going to come in at $1,500 per month. So just let us know what you'd like us to do. I think we might end up going ahead and doing commentary for a wrestling match that you can watch on the WWE Network.
Yeah, that's the one main suggestion we've gotten so far, is to do some wrestling commentary.
And that sounds like it might be fun.
It would be fun. So if that's what you would like to have happen, let us know and we'll do it. All right, here is the most recent crop of Patreon backers. All right, James McGee.
Oh, thank you, James. Long-time listener.
James D'Amato.
Oh, thank you, James.
Matt Fisher, that's my name.
Hey, that's your name. Thank you, Matt.
Sebastian Benoit.
Thank you, Sebastian.
Vanguard 616.
Oh, thank you, Vanguard. I'm sorry that your dimension of origin was destroyed so recently.
Craig Little.
Thank you, Craig.
Chris Rowling.
Hey, that's my name. Oh, and I know Chris Rowling. Thank you, Chris.
Dave Barbella.
Thank you, Dave.
That's my middle name.
That's true.
And those are the most recent Patreon patrons. We appreciate all of their support. Thank you for helping us keep the lights on. And now, Chris, it's time for us to do some checks and wrecks.
Let's do it.
Chris, what's been going on with you this week?
What's going on with me, Matt, is that I had a terrible experience on an airline. It wasn't on an airline, and that is the problem. It was not on an airplane. It was on the ground. I recently took a little trip, and when I came back, you know, I had a big flight and a short flight. You know, I had the bulk of my flight, and then I had the flight to a connecting, you know, a more local airport that is not a hub.
Right.
And the first flight was fine. The trip up was actually great. God is real, and I got an empty middle seat next to me, so I got to get some work done and play video games with elbow room. It was amazing. I love it. I have been blessed enough to get the middle seat a couple times in my life, And I don't know if there is a better feeling in the world. I don't know if there's a better feeling than when they say the doors are closed and you look next to you yourself in an airplane and there is no one there. The trip back, we ran into a little bit of weather. So now I was going to have a long layover. I was going to have a layover in the Charlotte airport, actually, that was like 3 hours long, which is how long it takes me to drive to Charlotte.
Right.
Because of weird airline things, it's actually cheaper for me to fly out of another airport and go to Charlotte than it is to just go to Charlotte and get on the same plane to wherever I'm going. I don't understand that.
I ran into that exact same thing when we were booking our tickets for London. Yeah. It was cheaper for us to fly out of Asheville, go to Atlanta, and then fly to London from Atlanta than to just go to Atlanta and get on a plane.
I was going to have a 3-hour layover in Charlotte, which was actually fine because, you know, I can sit there with the Transformers comics that I got, you know, as digital comics in the Humble Bundle, or with Batman 66 on DVD in my computer, and I can get work done. You know, sitting there for 3 hours with no distractions is weirdly and coffee. Like, I can walk 10 feet, get a coffee, and go sit down and work. That's kind of the best way for me to get work done. That forces me to focus in a way that not being in an airport doesn't. So I was already kind of prepared for that. But then they were like, oh, hey, due to weather, we're going to delay this flight by another hour. And I'm like, oh, well, that sucks, but at least I'll you know, get even more work done. And then they're like, okay, now we're going to cancel this flight, and you have to go wait in that line with 50 people who have also had canceled flights. Because apparently they were just canceling flights due to weather. Ours said they were canceled because of maintenance, which, all things considered, I would rather have a well-maintained airplane, so that's fine. But it was one of those things where it's like, okay, there are no flights until tomorrow night or the following morning. And then somebody was like, okay, now I was in Charlotte. And apparently in Charlotte this past weekend, there was a NASCAR race and there was a golf tournament, which meant that there were no buses in the city of Charlotte. So a lady comes up from the airline and says, hey, who was going to Florence, which is the airport I was flying into? Who's going to Florence? And I raised my hand. And she was like, we've got a van that can fit 10 people. So if you are from Florence, if you're one of the first 10 people to talk to me, we will just drive you to Florence. We will take you on a 3-hour drive. So I ended up getting in a van, which, you know, it was going to be a short flight anyway. So the experience of sitting in the van was exactly the same as the experience of sitting in an airplane, except it was on the ground and there was no seatbelt. And I thought, like, well, maybe since they canceled this flight and I did not actually get to ride, you know, ride in a plane for half an hour, maybe I can, you know, get some kind of credit. And I called and they were like, well, according to our records, it says you got to your destination. And I said, yeah, but I got there in a van. That was the problem. I did not get a short plane flight. There's a reason that I opted to fly instead of ride a bus to begin with. And they're like, nope, you got home. Nothing we can do.
You paid air prices for ground travel.
Yeah, it was great. It was great to sit in a van, unable to do any work, and just play the Nintendo DS for 3 hours and Marvel Puzzle Quest. Which, you know, to be fair to the airline, probably what I was going to do anyway. That was kind of a miserable trip. I'm still kind of playing catch-up on sleep and work from that. What did you do this week, Matt? I hope it was more pleasant.
I got some crazy news.
Oh. Okay, I hope it was good news.
Good, but also mega stressful. I'm super anxious about it, but I'm going to couch it in just how busy my next few weekends are. If you need me on a weekend, you might be out of luck. And it may affect how much I can actually edit this podcast in the near future, so mark your calendars with that. This weekend, Memorial Day weekend, I have a wedding that I'm going to be attending. In Nashville. Oh, okay. I've been invited to a wedding. I'm going to a wedding. The weekend after that, the last weekend in May, is my last free weekend for quite some time. Then, the following weekend after that, the weekend before my birthday, I will be in Memphis at the Memphis Comics Expo with supervillain books, Copernicus Jones issues, all that stuff. Skip a weekend. The weekend after that, I'm going to be at Heroes Con.
Hey, we'll be together.
Yes, we will be together. We'll probably record an episode there. And maybe some bonus content for Patreon backers. The weekend in between, I thought was free. The one between Memphis and Charlotte. But I got an email over the weekend from the Jeopardy contestant search department.
Aw, dip.
Telling me that I have an audition Sunday, June 14th at 9 a.m. in Atlanta. So that morning, I'm going to be waking up at like 5 a.m. to get really nicely dressed as fast as I can, put some junk in my hair, get in the car, drive to Atlanta, go to a hotel. I don't think I can tell what hotel I'm going to. They're very secretive about this stuff. I had to send an RSVP email to say what to find out what hotel I was going to. I'm going to go to this hotel, and then I'm going to spend between 2 and 2.5 hours taking a 50-question test, doing a personality interview, and then some kind of mock show. I am excited and terrified.
I am super excited for you, and I am not terrified, Matt, because I believe in you 100%.
Thank you, Chris. That means the world to me.
Hey, say your name to me.
My name is Matt.
Who is a future Jeopardy champion?
Somebody on Twitter, when I said I got a Jeopardy audition, said, "No pressure, but your entire life has been leading to this." I know that's a joke, but it's kind of not.
Oh no, it's kind of 100% true. You and I are both going through that feeling lately.
Yeah, I don't know if there's anything more that my life has been leading to than trying to be on Jeopardy. So, yeah, it's a big thing. I'm trying to not treat it as too much of a big thing. But I already know what I'm going to write if I get to Final Jeopardy and I don't know the answer. Feel like that's very important. What happens after this audition is I get put in a contestant pool for a year. So they could call me any time for a year to come be on the show. So that's where we are.
Wow, any time within a year?
Yeah.
So I mean, I guess they have to, because what if they have, you know, what if they have three-way ties for a year?
And nobody else gets to come on the show except those three people forever. All right, that's my check. It's a big one. I'm so nervous and excited at the same time about this Jeopardy audition. You will all be finding out more about it in the weeks to come.
Oh, I assume it will be all we talk about.
after I do it, yes. All right, let's do some recommendations. Chris, what do you have to recommend?
Well, Matt, I saw two movies this week.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to actually recommend both of them, if I can. If I can do a double recommendation.
We didn't actually do recommendations last week, so I think we can do that.
Yeah. So one of them, obviously, was Mad Max Fury Road, the new Mad Max motion picture. I thought it was great. I thought it was an absolute blast. It is fun. It is action-packed. I don't know if it was... I do feel like the amount of people saying this is literally the greatest movie ever made before I saw it, I do feel like they set a kind of impossibly high bar, but I did really, really enjoy the movie.
Yeah.
And the practical effects in it are amazing. I realized after I had watched it that I did not realize Tom Hardy played Mad Max because I have only seen Tom Hardy in one film. And he had a mask on his face and spoke with a weird voice and wore a weird fur coat in the entirety of that movie. But he's really good.
I can't believe you've never seen Tom Hardy in anything else.
Well, I've never seen Inception. I've never seen that movie he did with Shia LaBeouf.
Yeah, I didn't see that one.
I've never seen him in another movie, so I had no idea what he looked or sounded like.
Go watch Bronson on Netflix.
I've heard I should. Very enjoyable. Charlize Theron is great. It's such a Fallout movie, which, well, I mean, obviously the Fallout games are Mad Max games.
I mean, yeah, like, go the other way around. Like the Road Warrior is that as well.
Yes, It's great. It is not as good as the first movie I saw that day, which is Furious 7, which literally is the greatest movie ever made. Okay. I am going to spoil something for you, Matt.
Okay, that's fine.
I am going to spoil it, because that movie's been out for a while. If you have not seen Furious 7, you should go see it immediately, but also me telling you everything that happens in that movie will not change your experience of that movie. In the beginning of the movie, Dwayne The Rock Johnson fights Jason Statham. First 10 minutes. Okay? He does the rock bottom. He literally does the rock bottom.
I heard. Yeah.
And then Jason Statham pulls out a grenade and kind of blows up the room that The Rock is in. The Rock flies out a window and crashes on top of a car. We are told at this point that Dwayne The Rock Johnson's character, Agent Hobbs of the Diplomatic Security Service, has broken his arm and has broken his leg in two places. He is in the hospital. He was unconscious. He was concussed. He was knocked out. So he is in the hospital at the beginning of this movie. After he wakes up, he gives the information to Vin Diesel and sets the plot in motion. Now, in this film, Jason Statham plays the brother of the villain from Fast and Furious 6, who was Dracula in Dracula Untold, and is more Dracula in that movie than he was in Dracula Untold. I just want to make that clear. Now, the movie happens, and the movie that happens is perfect and beautiful in every way. At the end of the movie, Jason Statham and his friend, who I think is a warlord, arrive in Los Angeles to kill a bunch of street racers with an attack helicopter and a drone strike. Dwayne The Rock Johnson, laying in his hospital bed, sees this. He sees on the news that this is happening. He realizes that someone is going after Toretto and his crew. He turns. He doesn't say it to the camera, but he says the phrase, "Daddy's got to go to work." Now, this has been charitably, like, I figured it out. It's been charitably about 2 weeks since the beginning of the movie, because they have to fly to Azerbaijan and do stuff there. They have to, you know, armor a bunch of cars and plan some operations. They have to go to Azerbaijan. They have to go to Dubai, do a lot of stuff. But it all happens very quickly. So charitably, 2 weeks. Dwayne The Rock Johnson, leg broken in two places, arm broken, gets out of his bed, says, "Daddy's got to go to work," and then flexes so hard that the cast on his arm explodes. That is when I took my shirt off in the theater because I was so excited. Here's I texted you right after I saw it, and I was like, "Hey, do you know who's in this movie?"
You did.
Because here's who's in this movie: Kurt Russell, Ronda Rousey, and T-Pain.
And Tony Jaa.
And Tony Jaa is one of the bad guys. Furious 7 is the greatest movie ever made. I feel like Mad Max Fury Road suffered because I saw it literally 10 minutes after I was literally crying because of the tribute to Paul Walker at the end of Furious 7, which is so much more personal than I thought it was going to be. And it makes sense that it would. I mean, like, you do, you know, five and a half movies with people. That's a lot of time to spend. Like, you know, Vin Diesel named his daughter Pauline after Paul Walker. So I was in tears in the theater, having just been on the emotional ride of my life. And then I went and saw Fury Road. Fury Road held up. I think Fury Road is probably going to hold up really well. But Furious 7... I don't know why they should even call them the Oscars anymore. They should just call them the Diesels. And Furious 7 should get literally all of them. There's a point where they cut to Dubai and they play Turn Down for What?
That's amazing.
Movie's amazing. Matt, what is your recommendation this week?
Well, when we're talking about movies that we saw, I saw Avengers Age of Ultron, and it is fine. It is quite good. There was some dodgy special effects at the beginning. And, you know, it's a big blow-up Avengers movie, but I liked it first better than the first Avengers movie because I thought it had more of a story. If for some reason, if you're listening to this and you haven't seen that yet, it's worth watching. Absolutely. Not my recommendation, though. My recommendation is Bloodborne, which I've been playing all week. And if you listen to our episode where we talked to Laura Hudson and Bloodborne came up, you will know that she wrote an article about the feeling that you get from playing Bloodborne. And at first, the game absolutely destroys you. It seems impossible, and you are terrible at it. But you learn things. Every time you die, you learn something. You learn how to do a new move. You learn how to dodge an attack. You learn all this stuff. And in some ways, it makes the first few hours of playing the game into this amazing learning experience where you finally get to the first boss, and the first boss just wrecks you. Absolutely wrecks you. And then you figure out that first boss, and you kill that first boss with authority, and it feels so great. You feel such a sense of accomplishment that very few video games afford people. Certainly not now. It's kind of got like old school NES difficulty in that so much is trial and error, so much is figuring out the patterns of a boss, so much is figuring out what enemies are where. But once you figure out those things and you just go through and you dominate an area of that game, it feels so great. And Chris, I think this might be the selling point for you of this game. Now, you may not like it all that much because there's some like scary imagery in it.
Don't act like I'm a tiny child.
Chris, you don't like scary movies.
I don't like scary movies.
There's a lot of like H.P. Lovecraft in it, but there's also a lot of Dracula in it, so that might make you like it.
I do like that guy.
There's a lot of Brotherhood of the Wolf in it, which is a movie that will come up in our interview segment. The influences on the game are very clear. Like, there are definitely moments when I'm playing the game, and there's like a monster coming after me, and I'm like, ah, oh no, ah! Like, because it's not even that the monsters themselves are scary by their looks. They're scary because you know that they can kill you so fast. What I think might sell you on the game somewhat, Chris, is that it's basically a Metroidvania game.
Really?
Yeah, it's kind of one big continuous map with different areas. You figure out how to traverse the areas and what the next place to go to is. There are side paths that you can go on that are optional that you don't necessarily have to do. There are bosses that you can fight that are not required to beat the game. And there are items that you pick up to progress. And until you get that item, you can't go to the next area, the next like major area of the game. There's one part at the very beginning. You wake up in this clinic. Like, the very first thing that happens to you in the game is you get this weird blood transfusion, and then your character wakes up in this clinic, and you're kind of disoriented. You can go to a door and knock on it, and you can talk to this woman named Yosefka, and she'll tell you, like, I'll help you how I can, but I can't open this door because I've got to help the patients that are in here. And if I open the door, I'm going to let the monsters in. After traversing a huge section of the game, you come back to the back door of her clinic and go in and finally meet her. That's the kind of stuff you're doing in the game. Like, you see a door and you're like, I can't open that yet. And then you go through a big section of the game and then you can open that door, either from the other side or you get the item to open it. I love that kind of gameplay. I love how intuitive the gameplay is. And I complained on this podcast not too long ago about the game The Evil Within because it was cheap. It was an extremely cheap game that teased you with items, then made you go out into places where you could acquire those items, but like monsters would gang up on you and kill you. And it wasn't really fair. Bloodborne is never unfair. It's just exceedingly difficult. But once you figure it out, it plays fair with you, and you can really dominate it. And I think that's the difference between a punishingly difficult game that I hate and a punishingly difficult game that I love. Because Bloodborne is one of my favorite games in a very long time.
That really makes me want to give it a shot. But I have a feeling I would either be frightened or frustrated into quitting. So maybe I'll wait till it's on sale.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely thought I was going to be frustrated into quitting, too. But I've not gotten anywhere close to there yet.
Interesting.
So, for what that's worth. All right. Those are our recommendations. Chris, it's time to talk about some of the comics of the week. All right, we've been doing this every week. We've done comics reviews, so let's just keep the train rolling. Let's talk about Convergence.
Now, I fell down on the job this week, Matt. I did my level best to read every Convergence tie-in for a while, but I just did not have time to get through stuff this week.
Yeah. I didn't read any of the tie-ins this week. They were not the tie-ins, per se, that I was really into. A lot of those were in the first week, actually. But I read the Convergence main series. 7 was this week. We didn't do comics reviews last week, but number 6 came out last week. And I swear to God, Convergence number 6 should have been Convergence number 0. And Convergence number 7 should have been Convergence number 1.
Yeah, I mean, just flipping through it, there's a big page where a bunch of Supermans are fighting Supermans and Batmans are fighting Batmans, and that's kind of what I think everybody wanted to see.
Well, also, those two issues gave us the thing we've been asking for the entire time, which is the new 52 current DC Universe Justice League. They have finally shown up and are playing a role in the story, but they didn't do it until issue 6.
And Convergence is only 8 issues, right?
Right. They could have done 0, 1, and 2 and pretty much told the entire story of Convergence, because here's what the first 5 issues of Convergence accomplished. If you count 0, 6 issues. They set up Telos as a character, and Telos is still standing around in these 2 issues asking what his real name is. It established Brainiac as the person who set this whole thing up. And then Deimos ended up killing Warlord and sending Brainiac away to take over the planet where all these bottle cities have been brought. The big plot twist of issue 6 is that Deimos tries to go to everybody with a deal about how he can save them, but they've got to, you know, bow to him. They've got to call him their leader. But by the time, like, pretty much everybody says no to that. And so Deimos is just like, okay, everybody fight. So we're just back to where we started. We could have just started with Deimos in charge, or had Brainiac do the same things that Deimos is doing here. And then we would have gotten what happens in this issue, which is what Convergence has been promising the entire time. 7 issues in.
Yeah, and I mean, flipping through, you know, just having this one in front of me and flipping through it, like, first of all, it looks great. Aaron Lopresti is the artist on this issue, and I'm a big fan of his to begin with. And he's got some, like, Chris Sprouse stuff going on in this. Like, the big spreads of all the heroes fighting each other look really good. I love that there's a page of, you know, Superman rescuing Apollo and the Engineer. And saying, you know, I'm not leaving anyone behind, like, yeah, gathering people up. Like, you're right. This is exactly the stuff that I wanted to see. You know,
I liked issue 7. I don't understand why it's issue 7. It should be issue 1. Yeah. Like, everything up to this point has been prelude, has been prologue.
You know, every Convergence miniseries is 2 issues. So right. Maybe Convergence, like, 7 and 8 are the only ones.
Possibly. That's what it seems like. But I, you know, for better or worse, I liked Convergence number 7. I wish it had been Convergence number 1. All right. Let's talk about a comic that you wanted to talk about a lot, Chris. Yusagi Yojimbo number 145.
Yeah. Guess what? It's great. Guess what? It's amazing. I've written a lot about Yusagi Yojimbo over the past couple weeks. I was really, really excited about this because it is the first new issue of Usagi Yojimbo in 3 years. Stan Sakai went on hiatus a couple years ago, and you know, I think it is common knowledge that some kind of bad stuff went down with I believe his wife passed away, which is horribly sad. And I understand why he would want to step away from comics a little bit. But I am so happy to have him back. If you have never read Usagi Yojimbo before, I have said this time and time again, one of the great features of the book is how accessible it is. You can start with this issue. There are characters in here that have been characters in the book for years, but the way they are presented, you will be able to pick it up absolutely immediately. There's an engaging story. It's very much classic Usagi Yojimbo, but it's Usagi kind of wandering into this situation that is going far beyond his control and having to stick up with his friends. I cannot say this enough. It's been 30 years and there hasn't been a bad one. Like, it's been 30 years. They're all good. And getting this book back is really great, and I'm really excited about it. And I've just been reading back issues for the past 2 weeks, just starting with Daisho and reading on ahead. So definitely go pick this up. If you've never read Usagi before, you will be amazed at the amount of detail in the art, at the amount of action that you get in a single issue, at how immediately you're going to get hooked by it. And if you have read Usagi Yojimbo, then you already know what I'm talking about, and you probably just haven't picked it up in a while. So go grab this one, because it is fantastic.
All right, and we're going to close out by talking probably pretty briefly about A-Force number one. Now, Chris, I understand if you want to recuse yourself from talking too much about this, because you have a Secret Wars tie-in book coming out from Marvel very soon, X-Men 92.
Yeah, tomorrow, if people are listening to this the day it goes up, that comes out.
So go pick that up digitally.
Yeah, so I am conflicted in there's a conflict of interest in me discussing this issue, so I will mostly leave this to Matt. I will say I did read this issue. I did enjoy this issue, and I like a lot of the stuff that's going on with it.
I liked a lot about A-Force number one. I liked the I love the team. I love the setup of the team, the way that She-Hulk is in charge. I love seeing Nico in anything. And I love, you know, so much about, you know, the makeup of this team. Captain Marvel, the way she's portrayed in this, all of that. I think the art in this issue is fantastic. The one thing that threw me off about it is that in this issue one that introduces this team of all women superheroes who are supposed to be, you know, the women Avengers, is that we immediately get kind of pulled into some legal mumbo-jumbo. Some Secret Wars legal mumbo-jumbo. If you haven't read the issue, what happens is Miss America throws a shark. There's a shark that attacks the world of the A-Force. It's Arcadia, right? That's what it's called?
This district is Arcadia. And that is a megalodon, Matt. It's a dinosaur shark.
It's a dinosaur shark. Thank you.
It's a dinosaur and a shark.
They get attacked by this megalodon dinosaur shark. And Miss America, in a reasonable reaction, I believe, throws that shark outside of Arcadia and into another area of Battleworld. That is apparently against the law. That is against Dr. Doom's law. And Miss America must then be punished. So we get into all this kind of legal stuff with Dr. Doom, and then we see Dr. Strange later about how Miss America is being taken away and punished because of her throwing this dinosaur shark out. It feels like a little bit of a kind of a momentum stopper for something in a first issue. I get it. I get why we're doing it. It's to set up Secret Wars stuff more than this team. But I feel like for this book in particular, we really need to set up the team. Now, I do think that by the end of the issue, when we're introducing a new character and our team is motivated to find out where this Megalodon came from, we're heading into stuff I really want to see. I just think it's an interesting decision to, in the first issue that introduces this team, get pulled into the legal stuff. I can even come up with an explanation as to why that happens, because it seems like they're kind of being pushed down by the patriarchy immediately in the book. That kind of reads as interesting and something I would like to see explored a little more, but it's never stated. And I really just want to see this team in action. And I hope we see a lot more of that in the issues to come.
I think the actual crime is not just that she's crossing one of the borders on Battleworld between those districts, but that she damages, like when she throws the shark, she throws it through the shield, which is the giant retaining wall that separates Battleworld from something that I think is absolutely hilarious, which is that there's a giant wall, and south of that wall is just zombies, Ultrons, and Annihilus.
Yeah.
I think that is hilarious.
She throws the shark into zombie world.
Yeah, and it breaks the wall at that point. It, like, kind of chips the top of the wall.
There's a lot of talk about border incursion and that being her crime, really, but breaking the wall doesn't help either. I found it to be an interesting issue, and I love the premise, and I love the team. I just think the legal stuff is sort of a weird side direction to take that first issue in. All right, those are our comics reviews. Chris, we're going to talk to our guest, who is also writing a Secret Wars tie-in.
We'll so many conflicts.
Find out more about that as we get into the interview. Jeremy Whitley is who we're going to be talking to right now.
Joining us for the program this week, we're very excited to welcome back a friend of the show, someone that Matt and I had the pleasure of actually hanging out with in person, playing some card games with a few weeks ago. You will know him as the writer of the Princeless series of, I guess it's a series of miniseries now, right?
Yep.
And you will also know him as one of the writers of Conflict Alert, a story in Marvel's upcoming Secret Wars Secret Love anthology. Jeremy Whitley, welcome back to the program. How are you tonight?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I can't complain, except on the rest of the show where I will be complaining very loudly and very often.
I'm a three-timer now. Is this an exclusive club? Do I get a hat or a shirt or something?
I think you have to beat like the 38-time Matt Fraction record in order to actually get anything.
So I get an exclusive shirt as long as I back the Patreon, right?
right, exactly. For only $20 a month, patreon.com/warmarketingjazz. Jeremy, welcome back to the show. Now, obviously, you've got a Secret Wars thing going on. That's very exciting for everyone, I think. But we have had you on the show before to talk about Princeless, which is a really great series that I have been keeping up with since the very start, out through Action Lab. And I finally got a chance to sit down and read, I guess it's not the latest miniseries, but it's the third volume, which is all about pirates, which is a subject near and dear to my heart. We've got a lot of really good pirate comics coming out lately.
Yeah, it's I guess, still the most recent until next month when the next one starts. So it's, that volume is a long time coming. I think we had like a year in between volume 2 and volume 3. It's sort of fortuitous, like that story didn't originally exist, and then somehow the gap between volumes ended up spawning this volume as well, and sort of kicking off this character of Raven, who was introduced in that and is gonna have kind of her own thing as well.
I am not complaining at all, because I really, really liked this volume of Princeless. I really enjoyed her story. I really enjoyed her interactions with the other characters, which I think are very much worth talking about in a few minutes. But it is very clear reading this that you really like her as a character, and you really like writing her.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was the story of kind of Raven coming about was like I had volume 3 of Princess written, what's now going to be volume 4. And we were getting ready to, like, we found out we were going to be in Free Comic Book Day. And I wanted to do, actually, I was like, well, let's just cut out, you know, 10 pages of the first, you know, part of this volume and put it in. And I was like, well, I don't want something in there that people who will have picked it up because it says Princeless will have already read, but I want something that's a good introduction to the series. And so I sort of created this story with Raven being locked in a tower and, you know, Adrian, who's the main character of the series, coming to rescue her. And, you know, as I was starting to write it, I wanted to make Raven sort of a badass in her own right. So I started writing her, and you know, the you know, one of the first things she does is, you know, jump out of a tower with, you know, nothing but like a rope around her foot and start shooting arrows at people from the sky. And I was like, all right, I think I want to write more about this character. You know, so as soon as we finished that and I saw the finished product on it, I was like, yeah, I want to do like a whole fleshed out miniseries of this story. And then as I was writing that, I was like, all right, I'm not ready for her to go away yet. So I think I'm going to give her own series. And luckily Action Lab was on board with that. And I have a couple of like just amazing artists in Rosie Higgins and Ted Brandt who started off doing that volume to give us a little padding before what's now volume 4 would come out, and proved to be just amazing artists.
It very much feels like, and again, I say this as someone who very much enjoyed this miniseries and Raven as a character in general, but it does have that feeling of a backdoor pilot, you know, like of the episode of a show where this new character shows up and everybody's like, wow, that new character is really awesome. And then at the end they go, well, I'm going to go have my own adventures. I'll see you two later.
Yeah, like, shamelessly so. Like, it was just, you know, I had just sort of made her up as a thing, and for the Free Comic Book Day thing, and I just keep, like, she keeps getting more interesting as I write her, and I can't let her go, and I didn't have any room in, like, the upcoming stories, you know, in Princeless for her, because I'm already cramming as much stuff as I can into the miniseries. So I was like, all right, well, I'm just gonna do this thing. And despite the fact that, you know, we're a small little indie publisher that's got a handful of books coming out, I now have basically like a spinoff of my tiny indie series.
She is your Xena warrior princess.
Exactly. Except for Adrian is a warrior princess. So I don't know. It's, is she my Sinbad?
No, she Adrian's your Hercules. Adrian is your Hercules,
okay. I see.
Of Hercules Legendary Journeys, and see, and she even has her own Aeolus. It's a it is a perfect metaphor that nothing could ever poke any kind of hole in that at all. It's a perfect one-for-one metaphor.
Now I just need to find a Cleopatra 2525 to put on after it.
Oh, man. Were you an action pack guy? Did you enjoy the action pack?
Oh, yeah. I loved Hercules. That kind of got me started, and obviously Xena started, and I was like, oh, this is amazing. And I watched Sinbad with all its terrible special effects, and then what's Bruce Campbell's series?
Jack of all trades.
Yeah.
It is amazing.
It's so great. And I was on Facebook today, and Joe Illich always does these like today posts. He says today and then like a screenshot of something that expresses like what his day is going like. And it was like Gina Torres and the other two from Cleopatra 2525 like pointing space guns at people. And I was like, yes, I didn't realize that other people still remembered this stuff.
A few years ago, well, gosh, I mean, it was more than a few years ago now. It was, you know, it might be like 10 years ago. But Jack of All Trades came out on DVD, and it like was available through Netflix. Mm-hmm. And so I like jumped on it because, you know, that show came on like late 90s, right? Like early 2000s. I guess it was early 2000s.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it was well on Vern Troyer's rise to fame, right? Which, Jeremy, why don't you explain the premise of Jack of All Trades as you remember it before I go any further?
I don't even think I can. I don't know if I even understand the premise to that show. I think, like, it was just one of those that, like that and Cleopatra 2525 and, like, Andromeda and stuff like that. I was never quite clear on where these shows came from or why people could afford to put the kind of money that they must have had to into something like that. But, I mean, they were fantastic in their own right. Like, they're like weird B-movies for the TV.
In 1801, the revolution had been won. That is the first line of the theme song. Jack of All Trades was a TV show starring Bruce Campbell of Evil Dead fame, where he was a secret agent sent to this Polynesian country by Thomas Jefferson, where he and an English secret agent named Amelia Rothschild, who is portrayed by the very beautiful Angela Dachin, who I believe was from New Zealand, they were going to team up, even though and fight the French influence in Polynesia, I guess, which is such a weird show.
It's like they were actually fighting Napoleon, right? Like,
yeah, they're fighting Napoleon, who the big joke of the show was that Napoleon was played by Vern Troyer, who you may remember as Mini-Me from the Austin Powers movies.
I think this is the most information I've heard gathered about this show in one place.
Oh, I loved this show. it's a show that, like, combined everything I love. Like, it was a stupid action comedy show. It starred Bruce Campbell. It came on after Xena Warrior Princess. There's an episode that was written by Hilary Bader, who had worked on, like, Batman the Animated Series. it was about Bruce Campbell taking a superheroic secret identity. It was a forerunner of steampunk. That show was before its time. It's also, it ran for 1.5 seasons.
You know you're doing great with that half season right there. Like.
And I'll say, like, it's not great, right? Like, it's not great at all.
I'm just going to say, that half season is technically a second season.
It's only 7 episodes.
That on cable, that's a full season.
Eight episodes. 8 episodes. Excuse me.
I will count it as a full second season.
It is 14 episodes in the first season, 8 episodes in the second season. It is a season and a half. It is slightly less than one full season of a syndicated television show. But it was like, I got that, and like I said, it's not great, but it was exactly as good as I remembered it. Like, you know, it was kind of the perfect half-hour little weird action show to kind of while away a Sunday afternoon, I thought. Like, you know, however good you think it is based on my description, it is that good.
I feel like it's the Autolycus spinoff we never got from Hercules and Xena.
Oh, it is exactly the Autolycus spinoff. Because, like, Jack Stiles, the character, is exactly Autolycus, who, you know, starts out a little different and then becomes exactly Ash from Army of Darkness. The thing is, it was paired up, like, the full hour, the full syndicated hour was Jack of All Trades and Cleopatra 2525. So I also got the DVD of Cleopatra 2525, and let me tell you what does not hold up. Let me tell you what is immeasurably worse than you remember is Cleopatra 2525.
I feel like I could watch anything to just watch Gina Torres run around and be badass for, you know, half an hour. I mean, I feel like there's worse things that... I mean, granted, I haven't seen it in a long time, but...
Look, she's great. But she is elevating the material.
Yeah, there's no amount of material that can make Gina Torres not be Gina Torres.
Yeah, like, she is... Well, I mean, Cleopatra 2525 is close.
Yes.
If anybody remembers that show, the premise of Cleopatra 2525 was that a young exotic dancer... and again, this is the premise of the show. This is not something I am making up, so don't put this on me. There's a young exotic dancer whose stage name is Cleopatra. She is white and blonde.
Naturally.
Naturally. She goes to get breast augmentation surgery and then ends up being cryogenically frozen for 500 years and wakes up in the post-apocalyptic Terminator future. And then she teams up with two other women, and they're basically Charlie's Angels in the future fighting robots, which you might think, oh, well, that's, you know, it start, that premise started off a little weird, but it got good there at the end. It does not get good. It is actually very bad.
Did Sam Raimi have anything to do with that one?
I don't know.
Because I feel like he had a hand in Jack of all trades,
oh, yeah.
Right?
That was a Sam Raimi Rob Tapper joint. It was from the guys who brought you Xena Warrior Princess.
Yeah, that's what's super crazy about Hercules, Xena, and Jack of All Trades is that they were all made by the guy who went on to direct the Spider-Man movies.
Executive producers Sam Raimi, RJ Stewart, and Robert Dapert.
Yeah, but Sam Raimi was not a creator of Cleopatra 2525, and I think that's where you run into the difficulty. I think if he had been in the room...
It's just Stewart and Tapert on the creators.
If he had been in the room on that one, things might have gone a little different. It is certainly a Renaissance Pictures production. Yeah, that dude. They gave that dude Spider-Man. They gave him the best comic book character of all time. I guess now is when we announced that Action Lab got the rights to Cleopatra 2525, and we'll be writing it.
If only...
What is the project that you wish you could get the rights to, Jeremy?
It was possibly for a while Invader Zim, and now that's happening elsewhere. So I'm excited that, you know, Yonan Vasquez is actually doing that. But I think it would be on a very related note, Psychonauts.
Oh, okay.
Like, that game is so good, and it's so like tip of the iceberg of that universe. Like, there's so much more. It feels like there's so much more to it, and you know,
yeah,
Double Fine was just poor and weird and couldn't do it.
There's so much that's set up in that game that seems like it's absolutely designed to keep this world going and keep these characters going. And then they just, that's it. That is all you get of them. That one game.
And it's an amazing game, and it's so like, it's so different, and it's so ahead of its time, and that there's so much, you know, puzzle solving and these just weird environments that are all set in dreams. So, you know, there's the weirdest one is like there's a whole conspiracy theory level where like you're being hunted by milkmen, and you know, you have to at points you have to like jump to the upside down sidewalk and, you know, continue along the level from there, and it's so weird and so good, and I wish there was more of it.
Yeah, that's one that I've always heard about, but I've never actually played.
It's fantastic. And it's on Xbox Live Arcade, so you can buy it and not get achievement points from it, but it's worth the time for it.
Look, I am on PlayStation Network now. I have switched my loyalties.
You still have the 360. You can download it from there.
Like, no, I got rid of it. I threw it out the window.
What?
I threw it in the trash. No, of course I didn't. I still have video games for 360 that I haven't played. We will be discussing all the 360 video games I've played in 3 years when I finally get around to them. No, but let's talk a little bit more about Princeless, since we got on a weird diversion. Was the idea of doing a kind of piratey story, is that something you'd always wanted to link into the worlds? Because the thing that I really like about it is that it plays around a lot with the world building that you're doing in that book. You know, the idea of the four kings, and then, oh, but this is, you know, this is a pirate king that exists outside of that system. And it's the kind of world building that I think if you talk about it, you know, the reaction from people who maybe haven't read the comic would be something like, oh, that sounds like a boring bit of explanation. But you work it in there in a way that's really fun and entertaining. So was that something that you had in mind from that beginning of Princeless with Adrian, where, okay, this is how the world works. This is this system of people of kings who put their daughters in towers for some reason.
I mean, that's when I first started the series, and I was coming up with, you know, where every daughter was. It's this very sort of Final Fantasy-esque system where like every level is in a different climate altogether. So you know, I have the you know, there's the story that's the next one is the story in the swamp. The previous one was the story that's in the plains. You know, I've got one in the mountains coming up later. So like I wanted to do a sea story, a pirate story, but I hadn't didn't seem like a logical place to put somebody in a tower. Not that there's a whole lot of logic to that. I'd sort of been playing with it and what I wanted to do with it, and Raven just sort of unlocked that door, and all this pirate stuff I had piled behind it just sort of came tumbling out. So it's something I really wanted to do, and really, I guess, gave myself the in to do it.
Now, am I right in assuming that Raven as a character was at least partially based on famous 19th century pirate Ching Shi?
A little bit. Some of the basics, you know, I've wanted her to be in that sort of Chinese pirate history that's there, because the American pirate history is not always so kind to female pirates. I want to do something more in that sort of tradition. And so I played around a little bit with that, and I wanted to make her as unique from Adrian, to be able to have her own sort of stories as I could. So I tried to diversify it a bit there.
Now, the other thing that really struck out to me, about this series, was that you do play around a lot with romance between, between all three of the characters that are featured, one of whom just ends up kind of sleeping through three issues of the series.
Yeah, more or less. I wanted to focus more on Adrian and Raven, and after, you know, the second issue where they literally end up, you know, fighting on the back of a dragon as the dragon is flying, you know, to the sea, I was like, well, I guess I can't really go back from there. Like, I can't go back, pick up Bedelia, and then restart the story. So I was like, well, I wanted to focus on them anyway. I guess we'll just come back to her in the next story. You know, it was a thing with Adrian and Raven. It's an interesting thing as you read it, and I think a lot of people who are more attuned to it, who pay attention to it, have picked up that there's definitely like an attraction there. And as you get further into the series, it sort of becomes obvious what it is and who it is. Like, I've had several readers sort of that were excited about it and reposted a couple of panels from the end of the series where, you know, Adrian sort of, Raven is clearly like interested in Adrian, and Adrian is like, oh, well, this would be great. Like, we could be like sisters. And
yeah, that one, like, I read that and I literally said, oof, out loud.
Yeah.
That was harsh.
Somebody just posted like an image of like that panel and then like Raven's face in the next panel just getting, you know, closer and closer, because like the look on her face clearly says, nope, that's not what I was interested in. And Adrian is completely clueless. But yeah, I mean, that was like going in Princeless, you know, that's something that I wanted to touch on, was you know, to have my some of my characters be interested in people of the same sex. And in the case of Adrian, I didn't want to do it with her specifically, because one, she's sort of based on you know, one of my sisters my sisters-in-law who is not into other girls and would probably take that a little personally, considering everything that's like written about Raven or written about Adrian in the story, she seems to take very personally. So
yeah, I was going to say, if if Adrian is based on one of your sisters-in-law, this is your wife's sisters.
Yes.
And Adrian is constantly talking about how mean her sisters are.
Yeah, it's absolutely inspired by real life in that case. You know, I mean, the other thing was, you know, there's this whole sort of theme of Princeless is this, you know, not having to wait for a man to save you and not having to depend on, you know, men being independent and all that. And I didn't want that to get sort of crossed with the idea that, oh, well, she's just not going to wait on a man because she's not interested in men. Like, I didn't want those two ideas and messages to get mixed up in there. And I think it's a lot. I'm going to have a lot of fun with Raven in the next couple stories because, you know, the Pirate Princess ongoing is much more of a sort of a young adults kind of teen thing. So there's much more of room for focus on romance, and there's quite a bit more fighting than there is in Princeless as well.
Well, the reason it got me is because I read all four issues back to back today, and it was hilarious to me how Adrian is, you know, the scene where she's like, oh yeah, we're like sisters. Like, we're really close. Like, I really like you. We're just like sisters. And that's like, she's completely oblivious. But in the panel where they meet, like, and Bedelia's there, like, there are literally like hearts around her head. They're like, the background explodes into hearts when she sees Raven. Which there's such a complete lack of subtlety in that panel for Adrian to be so oblivious later. It was it's a very good gag. Like, it's very hard to read in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it's fun because Bedelia is sort of like the way I've written her. She's sort of in love with everybody. Like, you know, the first time she meets Adrian, she's really excited to, you know, to meet this princess, and that she's heard so much about her. And the first time she meets Raven, she knows all about Raven. Like, Adrian has no idea who she is, but you know, Bedelia like rattles off her history. You know, she's sort of Bedelia is all over the place and definitely you know, excited at the very least about everybody. Adrian is as usual sort of not paying attention.
So let's talk a little bit about what you're doing. You've got coming up. You've got the Pirate Princess ongoing, which is fun, which focuses on Raven and her, I assume, horrendously violent quest for revenge.
That's not horrendously violent, but, you know, we're getting
horrendously
there.
Violent, right? Yeah. Is that, like, just people getting their eyes shot out, I'm sure. I hear that issue 4 is just a very detailed keel hauling.
Well, the first issue does end in somebody being pinned to the ground and punched repeatedly, and then somebody being bludgeoned over the head with a bottle. So, you know,
well, that's pirate stuff. That's fun. You also have Princeless Volume 4, which is what is the subtitle of that one? Is it just Be Yourself?
Yes.
So you are giving up on the idea of metaphor and just putting the meaning right there in the title.
Oh, well, I've been doing that with every volume. The first one was Save Yourself. So,
oh, I guess that's true. I guess that's true. and then Pirate Princess.
Yes.
So you're encouraging people to torrent these comics, right?
You know, if they can't get them any other way, that's fine. Pirate the Princesses.
But as I said, you've also got a story coming up in Secret Wars, and from what you've told Matt and me, that is you're doing an Iron Fist Misty Knight story.
That's correct. It's they're two of my favorite characters, and it was the first kind of thing I pitched because I've been like, everybody has that one like random pitch for a character, like ongoing series that is probably never going to happen, and mine is Misty Knight. In the case of Secret Wars, when I was approached about it, it was like, well, all right, well, we want you to tell a romance story between two characters, and I was like, well, that's basically what I want to do anyway, is do, you know, a big Misty Knight Iron Fist story in the series, so let's see if I can cram all that into 7 pages.
So you're going to try to cram an idea for an ongoing series into 7 pages.
Yes.
That seems difficult. I would say that seems like a challenge.
Yeah, so I mean, the plus side to it is being in a Secret Wars thing. It, you know, takes place in a you know, in another world and another time. So I don't have to explain how Iron Fist and Misty Knight went from where they were in the last time we saw them in a comic to where I want this story to start. I can just sort of start it where I want to and go from there. So it's going to be a lot of fun. It has a sort of, obviously, a love bit. It also has a bit of not quite a Pacific Rim thing, but definitely giant monsters are involved. And it's also sort of about being married and having kids and trying to keep the romance fresh. So it's giant monsters and also a thing about, love and midlife. So
what was it about Iron Fist and Misty Knight that really that kind of attracted you to their relationship? Because I will say, they are one of my favorite couples in Marvel Comics. To be honest, Power Man and Iron Fist is one of my all-time perfect concepts. If I was going to make a list of, yes, this is a great idea. Power Man and Iron Fist would be on there because I love the interplay between those two. And I love the further interplay that you get with Misty and Danny.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I've always been a Heroes for Hire fan. It's always an idea I liked, with those two characters. And, one of the first comics that I read sort of by coincidence, because I just happened to pick it up when I was coming back into comics before I started writing, was Palmiotti and Gray's Daughters of the Dragon, which is the short-lived Misty Knight and Colleen Wing series. It's just one story arc about, them busting and then subsequently having to save a bunch of B-level villains. It's great and fun. And I was all right, I want to read more of this. And it doesn't exist. It faded into sort of the, what ended up being the Civil War Heroes for Hire. They just kept bringing on more and more characters until they finally just got rid of the series. I really loved that. The interactions between Danny and Misty and that. And then I started reading Fraction's Iron Fist after that, and that just, or I guess Fraction and Brubaker's Iron Fist, and that really got me hooked on them as a couple and on, that series was just, it was fantastic. I hated when that one died.
Yeah, it was a good one. And the Dwayne Swarzynski stuff that comes after, that dude had a hard act to follow. And he did a really stellar job with it, too. Those all sound like really fun books. I really can't wait to see what you do with Iron Fist and Misty Knight. But I think the time might have come for us to take a few questions from our listeners on Twitter.
That is indeed true.
Matt, how can people go about asking us questions when we have our little chats with our friends every week?
Well, you need to obtain some method of time travel. Either travel back in time to the era right after the revolution had ended and deal with the French influence, or get cryogenically frozen and get sent all the way forward to the year 2525 and fight robots. Those are your two choices. That's all you get. Whichever one you choose, before you leave, set up an account on twitter.com and follow the Matt D. Wilson, that's me, and the ISB, that's Chris. Wait until Thursday night at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time, that's 6:30 Pacific, and we will put out the call for questions for our guest. Once that's done, and you hear the question you have asked, like the questions you're about to hear right now, then go to the past or the future, whatever. Go be on some Sam Raimi show from the year 2000. The first question I have here is downright infuriating.
Is it a question from Charlotte Voss, Matt?
No, it's from Leesk on Twitter.
Okay.
Who wants to know, is a corn dog a sandwich?
That, Well, no, obviously not. There's no bread involved in a corn dog. It is a vegetable, but it is not a sandwich.
it's coated in fried dough. That's obviously not a sandwich.
Yeah.
Matt, okay. I told you it was a slippery slope. I warned you
What an insulting... All right, let's get away from that and ask this question from Adam P. Knave on Twitter. Adam wants to know, did Jeremy, your daughter, enjoy the finale of The Flash?
So my daughter and I have actually been watching The Flash since like the beginning of the season, and she's really into The Flash, except for the last episode, because like the first half hour of it was contemplating, and contemplation is really not her thing, freshly turned four. So by the time we actually got into the action of The Flash finale, she was attempting to bounce a bouncy ball off of the TV. So she had been forced to go to her room by the time the Flash finale actually ended. So I'm sure she would have enjoyed the Flash finale if she had been able to sit down long enough to watch it, because I loved the Flash finale.
If she's not into contemplating, then do not get her into Arrow. I'll tell you that much.
Now, your daughter is a fan of Matt Wilson's Flash recap, or Matt Wilson's Arrow recaps, right?
Yeah, Dylan Todd's Flash recaps.
That's where she's learned everything she knows about Arrow. So.
I would not recommend Arrow for a four-year-old. I wouldn't recommend Arrow for anyone, but particularly a four-year-old.
You know, I have this, like, I really want to watch and like Arrow because, like, it's been doing the crossovers with Flash, and every time they do a crossover, I think, well, that was pretty cool. I wish I was watching this other show. And then I go back and try to watch it, and, like, I realize that I don't know if you got this far, but there's a two-part episode in the first season with the Huntress.
I got that far. In history. I watched them all. That Huntress two-parter is the nadir of the show. It's terrible.
That was like they introduced the Huntress, and I was like, "This is going to be awesome. I love the Huntress." And like 20 minutes into that episode, I was like, what are they doing?
She's the most murdery character.
She's murdery, and the actress so they got murdery. Is just like...
She's terrible.
Boring?
Is it Helena Bertinelli?
Yeah.
Helena Bertinelli is kind of murdery.
She is. Her dad's a gangster, so she's super murdery, and yeah. Anyway, let me just tell you something that happens in the Arrow finale from this season. The whole season has been building up to how Ra's al Ghul wants Oliver Queen to become the new Ra's al Ghul, and he has been training. That's so
he's just Batman.
It's 100% true, and the whole season has been him training him to be the new Ra's al Ghul, and is telling him like he's got to do all this stuff to ensure that he's Ra's al Ghul. But in the finale, he just has this one full finger ring where he's like, ah, yes. This is the ring that makes me Ra's al Ghul. You'll get to wear this ring soon. And it's only there so that Ollie can pass off that ring to somebody else at the end of the episode.
So Green Arrow is Batman.
Yep.
And Ra's al Ghul is Ming the Merciless.
Kinda. But he just it's just a ring. That's what makes him Ra's al Ghul.
It's kind of
nobody kind says of Ra's al Ghul
that they dropped
way.
The pretense that he's not just Batman.
Yeah. All right, we got to move on. Let's ask this question. This is from one word long on Twitter. I don't even understand this question. Maybe you can enlighten me. Where do the pony serial killers go?
I'm just assuming that's a general My Little Pony question. In which case, the answer is always that they're banished either to the Arctic or to the bizarre human world that apparently it's okay to banish terrible, crazy people to.
Murderers. Murderers yeah. Get banished to the human world.
Yeah, just, you know, They try to take over the kingdom from the princess, so you just send them through a mirror to another world because that's acceptable. Some kind of weird Reed Richards logic. But then, yeah, otherwise you just banish them to the Arctic North and they show up 1,000 years later and nobody knows what to do.
I think that's canon. We can call that a canonical answer.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Sunset Shimmer killed a bunch of people.
It's two things. Like, everything that happened in the past of My Little Pony happened roughly 1,000 years ago, and everybody who was ever evil and terrible was banished somewhere or turned into stone. That's just Discord, though.
Our old friend Greg Black, Tales to Enrage on Twitter, asks this question. This is for everybody. Who is your favorite female fighting game character? And he says specifically for Chris, other than Chun-Li.
Yeah, I was about to say, Matt, you and I have been into that in our time together.
We have. Jeremy, do you have an answer for that? Who your favorite is?
I mean, it would definitely be Chun-Li. I don't know that there is like a close second there. Yeah, it doesn't say, I'm not Chris, so I can say Chun-Li.
Okay, fair enough. Chris, what's your answer?
Oh, Sakura. Easily.
Yeah, my second choice probably would have been Sakura. I'll say that I really like all the characters
Rumble Roses.
Yes, Rumble Roses. No, in Garo Mark of the Wolves. And Hotaru is really cool in that game. So maybe her.
I mean, depending on how loosely you want to define fighting game, my go-to character in Smash Brothers is Peach, so.
Yeah, I mean, I really like, I always go for Samus in Smash Brothers. I guess otherwise fighting game characters, it would then have to be Cammy. So I guess it just goes all Street Fighter.
It's hard to pass up all the Street Fighter characters. But SNK-wise, I think Garo Mark of the Wolves is probably my favorite of the bunch. All right, one last question. This one is also from One Word Long. One Word Long wants to know, what is your favorite fictional sword?
That's a great question.
That's a really good question.
We could go around the table on that one too, I guess.
Yeah, somebody else go first. I'm going to have to think about this one.
I don't remember the name of it, but I always liked Lion-O's sword from Thundercats.
The Sword of Omens, Matt.
The Sword of Omens, all right.
It gives him sight beyond sight.
It does. I liked how the logo changed on it, and I liked how when he did his whole transformation animation, the sword transmogrified into a cooler sword.
Yeah, it got longer and cooler,
yeah.
which is an interesting thing.
I mean, He-Man's sword did that too, but I liked the Thundercat sword more than the He-Man sword.
He-Man's sword doesn't change.
Does it stay exactly the same? It doesn't get longer?
No, it stays exactly the same.
Okay. He just changes.
He just doesn't know how to use it as Prince Adam. He's got it in his accessory, I guess.
Was that you being cringer?
Yes. Or Prince Adam, who's just terrible.
Yes.
I figured it out, and it pops up in like two pieces of pop culture and is equally awesome in both, but I don't think has a name in either, and it's the weird whip sword that Ivy has in Soul Calibur, but also is in Brotherhood of the Wolf, used to awesome effect.
That sword, in the Chess and Rec segment, I'm going to talk about this. That sword is in the game Bloodborne. It's a weapon called the Threaded Cane, and it is
a
sword
that gives me enough reason.
That turns into a whip, and it is awesome.
I feel like that gives me enough reason to go out and play Bloodborne now. Like, so that is just like we were just talking about like women in fighting games, and like Ivy is not that interesting of a character, but like that sword is awesome.
Yeah, there's a sword in Bloodborne that turns into a whip. There's a sword that turns into a giant hammer, and there's a sword that you put inside its own scabbard, and then that becomes a sword. Nice. The scabbard is a sword.
I feel like when that sword popped up in Brotherhood of the Wolf, like, I was watching it, and that was already a cool movie, and that was one of those moments where, like, I was watching it, and I just watching it by myself in a room watching the TV, I just went, what?
Somebody should make that a real sword.
I guess I have to play Bloodborne if there is a sword that turns into a hammer.
Yeah.
In that game.
You put the sword inside the hammer, and then you pull it out, and then it is a hammer.
Man, I don't know. I have spent so much of my life around fictional swords that it is really hard to narrow it down. I really like the laser sword that Batman has on Brave and the Bold that he pulled, that it's his utility belt buckle. When he pulls it out, it turns into a sword. And I especially like it because when I interviewed the producers of Brave and the Bold, I asked them about it, and they were like, oh yeah, when the toy people saw that, they loved it. It turns out kids love swords.
It's very true.
Yeah, so Batman's laser sword from Brave and the Bold is a personal favorite of mine.
All right, well, that is the note we're going to have to end on. Jeremy Whitley has been our guest. Thank you so much for coming on, Jeremy. Before we let you go, please tell our listeners all the different places that they can find you on the internet.
Okay, I am I'm on Twitter at jrome58, so it's JROME58. I'm on Tumblr at princelesscomic.tumblr.com. And I have a website now. It's just jeremywhitley.com, and it's still sort of gradually under construction, but it looks pretty neat.
Princeless is the series. Volumes 1 through 3 are out now. There's the Pirate Princeless ongoing coming out, and Princeless Volume 4, Be Yourself. Jeremy, thank you so much for coming on. You are always a blast to talk to and hang out with. I wish we could have talked about playing Coup. When you were down here.
Oh, we all lost terribly to Afua, so I think that wraps it up. Or Afua and Marlene, like, just killed us.
Yeah, Matt Wilson's wife is dangerous.
And Afua Richardson, who we have to get on the show to talk about how good she is at Coup.
Definitely. Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, guys.
Thanks once again to Jeremy Whitley. If you have not checked out Princeless, it is a great book. And if you have checked out Princeless, maybe you can ask us a question about it, because Matt and I have read it, and we like to answer questions in our listener question segment that we do every 2 weeks here on War Rocket Ajax. Matt, was that an amazing segue? That felt like an amazing segue.
I'm blown away by it, to be perfectly honest. You can ask us questions by going to our Tumblr, which is warrocketpodcast.tumblr.com. And I'm about to ask two recent questions from that Tumblr, both of which are basically the same question. And since we got two of the same question, it is clearly a burning question that needs to be answered. So here we go. This was asked by both Fuck and Yes and Infinity Joe on Tumblr. And I'm just going to ask both versions of it.
We did such a good job not swearing in this episode.
Too bad. Fuck and Yes asks, Chris, what did you think about the Jim and the Holograms trailer? Do you think it looked boring? I did. Can the flick be saved? Like it all. And Infinity Joe says, I'm sure you guys are going to go in depth on the Jim and the Holograms movie trailer. As a preview to that, on the Truly scale, what did you think about it?
Okay, Matt, did you watch the Jim and the Holograms trailer?
I did. I made one Twitter joke about it. And my joke was, I didn't know that it was going to be a found footage movie.
I saw that. That was good. That was a good burn. Related, one thing that happened to me when I saw Fury Road this week was that I saw the Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice trailer.
Oh, boy.
Which I have been going out of my way to not even see a frame of it.
It was before Avengers 2. And,
yeah, and there it is, 20 feet tall. Oh, boy.
My wife and I were sitting in the theater just saying to each other, as low as we could, Do You Bleed? They Matt, bleed.
I knew about Do You Bleed. Do like, I knew bleed. That going in because my girlfriend likes to growl that at me, just as you and Marlene apparently do.
Do You Bleed?
I did not know that trailer was going to open with a statue of Superman that literally has false God written on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, I guess 17-year-olds need movies too.
I mean, that's fair. So, that's fair.
But yeah, this gym movie. I watched the trailer. I had a couple talks with it with friends of mine. I talked about it with Betty Fillon, obviously, one of our many conversations about gym that we've had over the years. Here's the thing about that gym trailer, and this is what is in that trailer. Although I will say, there is not a lot that we have heard about the gym movie that is very promising. I think the cast is decent. Hayley Kiyoko is playing Aja, and she was in the live-action Scooby-Doo movies that were kind of direct to Cartoon Network, I think. And while those movies made me very angry for Scooby-Doo reasons, she was very good in them. She was Velma. But from that initial cast announcement, like, I am so excited about Juliette Lewis as Erica Raymond. Like, that's a great idea. There has not, after that, there was not a lot of good things that we heard. It was like, oh yeah, they filmed it in a week. like filming's already over. They just announced that this movie was happening and filming is already over. There's no, you know, the Misfits aren't in it. The holograms aren't in it. The earrings aren't in it. There's no dead parents. There's no, like, they're taking out a lot of what I think makes it gem. And a lot of what you see even in the Kelly Thompson, Sophie Campbell comic that I really, yeah, really like.
Well, I'm not the gym fan that you are.
Very few are.
Yes. But even from my point of view, you know, I see this trailer and I think, aside from face paint and pink hair and them being a band, they seem to have taken out everything that makes it gym.
Yeah.
It's your run-of-the-mill music success movie with some gym stuff kind of haphazardly stapled onto it.
Here is the problem. Judging purely by what is in that trailer, they are making a movie with the same plot as Josie and the Pussycats. And Josie and the Pussycats is legitimately one of, if not the best comic book movies ever made. It is 10 times smarter than everybody thought it was. It's hilariously funny. Everyone in it is great. Even Tara Reid is really good in that movie. I feel like Jim and the Holograms is trying to deal with the idea of three or four girls who suddenly become very famous and kind of go viral and get chewed up by the hit machine. And I feel like there's nothing in that trailer that looks as clever as Josie and the Pussycats, which is to its detriment. And that is my problem with it. Like, that is my problem that, you know, if that is that movie, I have the best possible version of that movie. And that movie is not going to be as good as Josie and the Pussycats, unfortunately. What I do like about the trailer, and I actually like this about the casting too, I actually like kind of gender swap that they did with Eric Raymond, you know, making him Erica Raymond and getting Juliette Lewis for the part. I like that it is even in a trailer, almost exclusively focused on women, which is nice because Jem is very much a girl's show and it was created by a woman, Christy Marks. It was geared towards women. With the exception of Rio, I think Rio appears in the trailer. It's all women. Like, even Jerrica's dad is kind of replaced by Kimber and Jerrica's aunt, who's raising them. The one thing that is not in that trailer that I wish I would have seen, and the one thing that I really think could save the movie, is Juliette Lewis. I think if Erica Raymond is as evil, as scenery-chewing, murderously evil as Eric Raymond was, and if Juliette Lewis, like, really goes for it, which she definitely can, I really like Juliette Lewis. I think she's great. Then I think she has, like, it is entirely within her power, and kind of only within her power, to save that movie. But in my head, I realize that that is because I really, really like Parker Posey and Josie and the Pussycats. So, I don't know. Now, again, that's what, like, 2 minutes of footage from what is presumably a 90-minute movie?
Right.
So I'm holding out hope. I hope the movie is better than it looks. That trailer I did not think was impressive, but I am also clearly, like, look, I am a 32-year-old man who is 100% driven by nostalgia. I am not the audience they are going for with that. And I am definitely not the audience they're going for with that trailer. that, you know, kind of makes it look like an ABC Family show. Like, they are going for a completely different demographic to which I do not belong. So that movie is not for me, and that's okay. But personally, if you want my opinion as a guy who is actually really excited about there being a Jem movie and getting Jem comics and Jem kind of coming back because I like that original show so much, that show that I came to in my 20s, the trailer didn't do a lot for me. I hope it's good, though. And honestly, I hope it's a success, because good Jem stuff means more good Jem stuff.
And, you know, more movies that have women in lead roles is also something worth having. But I feel like Pitch Perfect 2 is kind of doing the work that the Jem movie might have done.
Are there holograms in Pitch Perfect 2?
I do not know.
Okay.
One more quick one before we wrap up. This is from On Mars, On Mars, On Mars. Who, in your opinion, has the best DDT/cutter style finisher in wrestling?
Oh, well, those are two completely different kinds of moves. I think, like, moves that just... is that the category of moves that you and I have talked about where it's quick and you can hit it on anyone out of anywhere?
I mean, I feel like the cutter, like, it's cutter slash neck breaker that's always kind of in the same category.
Well, I think we've talked about how the diamond cutter and the DDT are similar in that they are both moves that, you know, you and I could do it. Like, I could do a DDT on a guy. You could do a DDT on a guy. Because you don't have to pick anybody up.
Well, yeah, the cutter is the same kind of thing. Yeah. Most of the work is on the person taking it. but do you have a choice? Do you have a pick for who has the best one? Is it Diamond Dallas Page?
I think, like, you know, circa, you know, 96, 97, Diamond Dallas Page, when they were putting over the cutter as something that was both lethal and that could come out of nowhere. Like, he would debut a new variation of it every Saturday night is, you know, really good. I will say the one that happened at WrestleMania this year with the RKO.
Yeah.
That was the best one of all time.
Yes.
Like, that single one was the greatest. It's not quite something that you can do on anyone, but Kevin Owens and that pop-up powerbomb are really, like, really doing really well. And he did do it to John Cena this week.
He did.
Which was amazing. I like a good spinning backfist as well.
I mean, this is a pat answer, I think, but I think the Stone Cold Stunner, I think it just, like, it has more to do with, it's not even the execution of the move. I think it has more to do with the fact that when Stone Cold Steve Austin would do that stunner, he would be able to just, like, pop up and, like, yell in somebody's face. And, like,
he does that, you know, kind of thing where he, like, makes fists and kind of pulls them in.
Yeah. But he would do that thing where he would, like, he would be yelling and kind of shaking his head around. And that adds to the theatrics of it so much that that's what I think makes that move entertaining, is that you're like, you know, like, it's just like, oh, he's giving him hell.
Do you have a favorite stunner? What is your favorite stunner of all time?
Everybody says that Vince stunner, but I hate that Vince stunner because Vince takes it so badly.
Vince did take it really bad.
I like it. I think it was WrestleMania 20 when there was that disaster of a match between Goldberg and Brock Lesnar.
Mm-hmm.
When everybody knew they were both leaving.
Yeah.
And so that match ends with Austin stunning both of them. And that's very sad. Those are two very satisfying stunners because they cut that tension.
I think the one that everybody goes to is the one he does on The Rock, where The Rock, like, backflips coming out of it, which is amazing. One of, if not the all-time best Stone Cold stunners, you know, people who take it, Shane McMahon.
Shane's a very underrated wrestler.
Shane was shockingly great, except for those little brother punches, as they are called.
Yeah.
You know, Shane got through, you know, Kurt Angle tried to throw Shane through a window and it didn't work, so he got up and did it again.
Didn't he do it twice?
He did it. He did it going through the one way and then the other way.
Yeah.
It's at Unforgiven 2000, and I know this because it's the most recent episode of the Attitude Era podcast, and it's when they're dealing with the whole Who Ran Over Stone Cold thing, and it's Stone Cold's first night back, and he comes back, and Shane solves the mystery. He claims to have definitive proof, but he doesn't. It's just I think it's because he's feuding with someone, I forget who. And it might be Benoit, so I'm not just saying I forget who because I don't want to talk about Chris Benoit, although I don't. But he like presents his evidence, and it's not actually the case, but he's acting like it is. And so Stone Cold like is celebrating with beer, and Shane takes a big mouthful of beer, and then he gets the stunner, and he does the thing where he spits it out like a fountain, going all the way back in a perfect arc. And that it's beautiful. Shane McMahon, he's great. I miss him. I miss you, Shane. Mourn you till I join you.
All right.
Whatever you're doing now.
That's going to have to be it for our listener question segment for this week. If you would like to send us a question, as I said, go to warrocketpodcast.tumblr.com and leave us a question there. You can also email us questions at warrocketpodcast@gmail.com. That is also where you can send us every story ever lists. We're going to do our every story ever special very soon for May. And you can send us lists for the word heavyweight champion. Also, be sure to check out our website, which is warrocketajax.com. That is where you can read show notes, stream the show, download the show, and leave comments. You can also read the Every Story Ever and Word Heavyweight Champions list, which I'm going to try to get updated this week. I'm really going to try. Also, be sure to check us out on iTunes. If you go to iTunes and you search for War Rocket Ajax, you will find the show. If you like the show, leave us a review. The more good reviews we get, the more we are featured on iTunes. Now we've reached the part of the show where we tell you all the different places you can find us on the internet. For me, all you have to do is go to about.me/MattDWilson, and you will find links to all of my stuff. Chris, where can everybody find your stuff?
Everybody can find links to everything I do at about.me/ChrisSims. This is it, everybody. X-Men 92 number 1 drops digitally tomorrow, Tuesday. I feel like I am about to throw up literally all the time. So I'm very nervous about it. I'm very anxious about it. I hope everyone enjoys it. I've been doing a lot of interviews for it, Chad and I, lately. I hope everyone gets a kick out of it. But I will say it's not the book you think it is, I think. It's very fun. I think it's very enjoyable, but I think about halfway through that first issue, it is going to become apparent that we're not quite doing the thing that I think everyone is expecting. There is a preview that's up if you haven't checked it out yet. It involves the X-Men getting attacked while playing laser tag at a mall because we really wanted to go 90s with it. I hope you guys dig it. Please check it out. If you have a choice between getting it in print and digital, obviously get both and get several copies for all of your friends and relatives. But if it's one or the other, I would say check it out digitally. Scott Kalbush has done a lot of really amazing work with the Infinite Comic style scene transitions and stuff of that nature. He's absolutely killing it in terms of all the weird stuff that we're putting in the script. It has been an amazing experience to work with him. That's this week. I am going to go throw up now, I think, because that is the first time I've said it. It's coming out. Thank you for listening. This has been War Rocket Ajax number 255. We will be back next week. We have some great guests lined up coming up in the future. So be here next Monday. And we will talk to you then. Have a great week, everybody. Yeah!